Where we're just speaking offline, whereabouts are you currently? If you would explain your location, because we've got plenty of Australian listeners. Whereabouts are you over in the UK?
So I am originally a Londoner. I'm a very proud Londoner. We're a dying breed, the original Londoner. But now I live down on the south coast of the UK, so the southeast coast. I live in a little place called Ramsgate, which is on the beach. The British beach, of course, is nothing like the Australian beach. We just probably have to clarify that. But you know, I like being out of the rat race. I was in it for 40 years, and it gets tiring after a while.
Yeah, what is a British beach like? Is it like surfing and blue and dolphins and snorkeling and
Look
all
like a
the
postcard.
sights? Or
I mean, it's just like Bondi. It's exactly the same.
But better, way better.
Oh yeah, we you know, just unbelievable.
Soft sand, I'm sure, as well.
So some of the British beaches are sandy, and some are pebbly. So I think one of the issues is depends where you are. If you're kind of on that English Channel, it tends to be a little bit more pebbly. Maybe there isn't enough waves and energy to create sand. Where I am is sandy, I'll have you know. And of course, I swim with dolphins on a daily basis. No, it's sandy. That you would never, unless you're down in Cornwall, we don't get to do things like surfing and stuff. But I do love to take the dog for a walk down on the beach, listen to the surf gently lapping against the, you know, the beach and that kind of stuff. So it's good. It's very cathartic living by the sea, I find.
I'll be looking forward to a postcard of you maybe potentially riding some dolphins with the nice waves in the background. You're saying
I'm
greetings from
stro
the
stroking both dolphins.
UK.
Either side.
So how did your I guess your origin story for Ben Cormack, I mean that's who we have on today. What's been your origin story? I mean, how did you well firstly, where did you train and do your undergraduate? And then how did you get into private practice and then now to, research and then to presenting and educating? What's been the journey?
Yeah, so I went to uni many, many moons ago, started in the 90s back. I went to the University of Southampton, actually, which is further down the south coast, proper south coast, or probably more a little bit southwest rather than straight down. Actually, I went to a little university of the University of Southampton called Chichester, originally. And yeah, so actually probably something people don't I what I studied originally was something called sports therapy, which is more sports injury related. So actually my first interest in all of this stuff was sports injury, and I wanted to go and work. And originally I worked a fair bit in football. I worked a lot in boxing, and people who know me know that I love my
That's why I see
boxing.
you boxing on the Instagram. You can throw a couple. I see you on there, like, don't mess with this
So
guy.
actually that's kind of how I first got into it, because I always boxed, and then I didn't kind of know when I was, you know, a lot younger exactly what I wanted to do. And someone said, you know, why don't you go and do something sports injury related? So that's what I decided to do. Worked quite a lot in boxing, worked quite a lot in football. And then I kind of realized that sports injury was quite boring in some ways. You know, you'd see a lot of the same stuff, especially, you know, football, for example, you know, mostly lower limb, you know, another high ankle sprain or a hamstring or whatever. And I kind of developed, firstly, I developed quite a strong interest in biomechanics. So I was kind of functional biomechanics and understanding more about, you know, not just the foot, for example, how it related to the leg and the knee and the hip and all these other things. And then I got a bit of an interest in motor control. And it was like, this biomechanical thing, maybe there's something else in there, you know, maybe we can look even above the thoracic spine up into the brain and things. And I think from that, looking at motor control and understanding kind of the afferents and efferents and proprioception and things like that, I got interested in pain. That was kind of another step from, and this was a very neurocentric kind of time. We're probably talking mid-2000s, maybe later 2000s. And there was the kind of lots of pain stuff coming out, you know, Moseley and Butler and all these type of things. And because I'd kind of developed this interest in motor control and the brain, that kind of therefore came through into this kind of, this brain place is quite interesting. And you know, thinking about pain and brain and these type of things. And then I kind of, I think I then that kind of interest, I started to get interested in pain, and I started to think about working, you know, with more persisting pain populations and just broadening, I think, my interests rather than just kind of sports injury, biomechanics, and those kind of things. And then as I've gone along, that spread into, you know, interests in immunology and neurophysics, you know, kind of the whole spectrum of what makes up the human ecosystem, if you like.
And was that purely from you having any failed experiences, or it was just interest? Like you were treating on a very through a biomechanical lens and like, this isn't really working as well as I think it should. And then you kind of went to the next stage, or it was just, I'm just interested in everything and let's just see what's out there.
Probably a little bit of both. I mean, when I was strongly in my functional biomechanical stage, it always worked. Remember
I love that you use functional in
that.
there. You got to add that
Yeah. And but
buzzword.
that's what it kind of was, looking at this kind of, you know, biomechanical perspective, maybe not just the local area, but you know, the whole shebang type of thing. And there was a long time where it works perfectly every time. 60% of the time it works every time. And then over a little bit of time, I started to kind of, you know, question at that a little bit. And then as I broadened these interests and new things kind of came along to me, I think that started to poke holes in my own confidence and my own beliefs. So I think they work in tandem in that, you know, sometimes you get new interests and they kind of start to poke holes in what you do. And so they it's kind of a kind of an iterative or a cyclic process, I think, of, you know, learning new things, certain other things don't make sense. So I start to notice they don't make sense. And now I'm just ended up, I have no idea what's going on.
And it's cool because it sort of builds on each other. So there's like layers and foundations that allow us to be good clinicians and look at things from a very well-rounded perspective. And then it's fascinating though, because we've got all this knowledge in biomechanics, and then we've got all this knowledge in motor control, and then now we've got all this knowledge on pain neuroscience. But persistent pain and particularly chronic low back pain is still such a big burden on the healthcare system, but it shouldn't be, because we know everything about biomechanics and we know everything about motor control, and we're pretty close to knowing everything about pain, surely. So why is it such a big problem?
I mean, I would love to have an answer for that big question. I suppose, yes, maybe we exhaust our knowledge in some areas and it starts to help us understand that those areas maybe don't simply explain the problem that we see. So, I mean, look, if we take back pain, what's the percentage that goes on to be kind of really persistent and chronic? It's like somewhere between 20 and 30%. And the big question is why? Is it autoimmune? Is it comorbidity related? Is it things that I can't actually affect? And at the moment, I don't know if anyone can affect those type of things. So it might be at the moment we just don't have the interventions to affect those people, unfortunately. You know, talking can help, moving can help, you know, other things may help as well, but fundamentally, it might be that, you know, we do see changes within how the body processes certain things, and changes its, you know, epigenetics potentially, or, you know, again, comorbidities. So, you know, if you have chronic back pain, you are also likely to have a whole bundle of comorbidities that are going on. So it shows that it's, you know, a bigger problem than maybe what we can solve with exercise or manual therapy or cupping or, you know, CBT. At the moment, we probably have to admit that there is a subset of people that we don't know exactly what's going on. And I think that's, you know, that's important that we admit that, because then we don't think we have all the answers.
Do you think the location that chronic low back pain happens around the world gives us more information around it? I mean, it's a lot more common in westernized countries, but or is that just an absence of evidence in other countries? Or what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, certainly I think that back pain has a strong societal influence, in the sense that And this is not a new discussion. You know, we have John Lusa, we have Gordon Waddell, we have, you know, Norton Hadler, who've been bringing up these kind of wider societal perspectives about back pain for a long time. When it comes to kind of developing economies or developing nations and back pain, I think, yes, there's probably a little bit of a lack of data that people don't always engage in, and it's harder to reach people to collect data. So I think there's challenges there. Interestingly, how I understand it is there isn't so much differences in the prevalence of pain per se. What we see is difference in prevalence of disability. So maybe the prevalence of pain is quite similar, but the prevalence of actually disability and disabling pain is different. And maybe we can explain that through the lens of economics. And, you know, if I need to go to work to feed my family, there's nothing to fall back on. You know, lower back pain is less likely to be disabling, but maybe it can be still as impactful. But one of my other things I think is in you know, our more developed nations is I probably think it's a good sign that people are allowed to be disabled to some degree within it. Does it show that we have evolved as societies to allow disability, to allow those people with problems to be able not to have to go to work and these type of things? So I actually sometimes see it as a little bit of a positive as well,
That's a very
that
positive
we have
lens.
disability, because it maybe shows the evolution of society as well, potentially.
Do you... Sorry, I was just cutting you off. I was just
You go for it, sir.
on that topic. Do you think for people to help patients understand that that may be the case for the foreseeable future, and being okay with having that disability is one of the really challenging parts of being a clinician?
Yeah, so look, so there's I think that's the other side of it, isn't it? Is that with this allowing disability or society having this element of this safety net, is there always going to be a dark side of that whereby, you know, that becomes a problem within itself to some degree? So, you know, sorry, can you repeat the question for me? My brain just went off on a mad tangent.
No, that's okay. I was saying around, clinicians and people seeing, and whether it be back pain or any type of pain, helping people understand that potentially having some disability for the foreseeable future, that's very hard to help them understand that. And we don't really have a great clear-cut way to help that be the case or help that happen.
Yeah, so look, I think when it comes to disability, I sometimes think that I don't know if I particularly address that with people. People address it with me, and the sense of, you know, their participation in work, their participation in social stuff, their participation in these type of things. I suppose what I'd like people to know, or make my major discussions tend to be that, you know, that's not abnormal. It's not strange for work and purpose to reduce when you have long-term persisting pain. It's not nice, it's not ideal, but it's also not abnormal. And I'd also like help people to sometimes, if we can't impact on pain, and there are a subset of people we've been shown not to be able to do that with, you know, that's one of my failures as a clinician. I'm fine with that. Can we also talk about how do we reduce disability and how do we reduce the impact of pain? And one of the things that I discuss is, you know, although it's not easy, how do we make pain less of a proportion of life? So one of the biggest impacts of pain is that, and I have this slide on my course where we have two circles. One is a big circle of pain and a small circle of life. So the percentage of life is dominated by pain. And one of our roles sometimes clinically, if we can't help people with pain, is sometimes to help them find opportunities to grow life again. Because at the end of the day, the least impact there might be that, you know, even if we do have pain, does it become less of a percentage of life? And I sometimes think people can find that empowering. I'm sure some people say to me, Ben, you've never lived with long-term persistent pain. It's not that simple. And I would put my hands up and say, absolutely. But it's something that I've seen from people with chronic pain over the years that I've worked with and learned from them, that sometimes they've learned how to live well with some pain, not waited for that pain to go away.
Are you having a conversation with them that they might have to deal with pain forever? Like, are you eventually starting to make them realize that, or is that something that you're just avoiding? And at what point do you have that conversation, if so?
Yeah, and that's I mean, look, part of our role as clinicians is always to try to set realistic expectations. You know, and you, sometimes expectations are way too low, sometimes expectations are way too high, and we have to kind of normalize them somewhere. I think with people with persisting pain, I would never say to someone, you're not going to get out of pain. That's something that I don't know. I would never, ever say that. But I might say pain might not go away tomorrow. And I think that's an element of acceptance that it might be a little bit of a long-term process, that it's not going to go away tomorrow. I haven't got a magic click or exercise that's going to do that. And it might take hard work. It might take, you know, full starts. It might take some real ups and downs. But I'd always like to keep a bit of optimism and hope in there as well. But I think that's part of the role of acceptance sometimes. It's not to resign ourselves to it's never going to go away. It's to accept that it might not change in the next 5 minutes, and I might have to work at changing that by being uncomfortable or doing things that I, you know, find worrying or scary or painful to some degree. So I always like to keep optimistic, but I also like to keep realistic as well. But I would never say, because I don't know you're not going to get out of pain. How do I know that? I just don't. So I'd like to keep optimistic in that sense, but I'd like to be realistic that, you know, an analogy I use is if you've walked into a forest for 5 minutes, it's going to take 5 minutes to walk back out. If you've had pain for 5 years, it might take some time to reverse that kind of biological adaptations that may have happened. And that's what a lot of people don't understand, I think, is that there are things that predispose us to pain, such as risk factors. There are things that initiate pain. And then there are also things that maintain pain over time. And so what the original problem may have been may have long gone. But it's some of those psychological or physiological adaptations that occur that maybe we have to unravel over time. And again, that biological adaptation, whether it's positive or negative, takes time.
That's reassuring, because we both manage, you know, people very similar, where, you know, focusing on pain is very difficult, because, as you said, it may not change for the foreseeable future, but focusing on what their meaningful activity is, whether it be walking or running, and then using that kind of exposure. One of the learnings for me starting in my first kind of 3 to 4 years was just being in basically shock that I couldn't help everyone get from pain to pain-free completely. And then seeing all these persistent cases where, like, it's an actual successful treatment if we get you back to running with manageable pain, or you can walk around your block with a 3 out of 10. And before I was like, no, we've failed. You didn't get out of pain. But now helping people understand that is probably something. And I've certainly seen that from your socials, which has been great, and your content. It kind of, it's reassuring to hear that other people are doing that. And that's probably where the evidence is, because no one's got the answer.
Yeah, look, I think there has to be acceptance that from sometimes from the patient side that it's not going to change tomorrow. And there has to be an acceptance from the clinical side that we haven't got all the magical answers, even though we'd really like them to. And sometimes the best results happen when we both have acceptance and we meet in the middle.
Now, I want to tell you a story, and I purposely haven't mentioned it offline or in the email we sent through. I was in my fourth year as a clinician, and I was very heavy into the biopsychosocial model. I've just discovered it, a podiatry background. So I was a bit more, I guess, kinesiopathic, biomechanical, and the BPS model comes along, and I thought, this is it. This is the answer that I've been looking for. Everything makes sense. And then I come across, this is the first time I ever had any connection with your content, your paper. Someone shared it online, and then I had a read, and then actually ended up following you, and here we are, so small world. But that paper was incredible, and it just put me in my place a little bit. It was an awesome read, and I encourage people to read it, and we'll tag it down in the show notes. What was your kind of introduction to the BPS model, and what do you see really good about it, and what do you see not so great about it, and it kind of not encapsulate within healthcare?
Yeah, so I don't know if I had. Yeah, I don't actually. Now I'm thinking about it, I can't remember a moment where I came across it like, oh my God, type of thing. I don't know whether that's just that I'm old and my neurons aren't working very
You
well.
can
It's early
remember
in the
it.
morning.
I remember it like it was Christmas. It was the best day of my life.
Yes.
Like, this is it. I don't have to do any more reading anymore. I've got this model. Put it on the fridge. I'm done.
I think I wrote a blog back in about 2012 when blogging was a thing. And I used to love blogging because it really helped me organize my thoughts. Now no one reads them.
I
But
read them. I'll put my hand up. I'll read them.
Good man, good man. The attention span sometimes of people has diminished to an Instagram slide. So I wrote a blog called Talking About Single Factor Thinking. And so we're searching for that one thing that's out of line or that muscle that's not firing. And I think that that probably was influenced by, the BPS model at the time. Although I don't know if I'd really got into it then because I was maybe not in that phase of my own development. But when it comes to the BPS model, one of the problems is the original BPS model, and me and Peter Stilwell and Joe and Sabrina, who wrote the paper. What the genesis of that was that Peter wrote another paper called Beyond the Biopsychosocial Model, which is a brilliant read. And I'd known Peter for years, and I just messaged him and I just said, "Are we beyond the BPS model, or have we ever actually even applied it?" And I think the point was there to go back and say, "What did the original model talk about?" Because I think it's been bastardized slightly. So. But for me, a lot of the original discussion, and this is what I tacked on later, was the original discussion was about humanization. So it's about understanding that there's a broad ecosystem in the world of, all these different elements, but essentially there's a person with a life and all of these type of things. Now, one of the problems we have is we tend to biomedicalize the BPS model. So what we want to do is we want to pick out all the component parts. So I can say, you're not sleeping, your job is terrible, all of these different things. But I can sometimes treat that all of those things without ever treating the person. So fundamentally, the BPS model was about healthcare is a really difficult space. We're always looking to reduce it, to reduce it, to reduce it down to this one thing. And that doesn't work. And we need to come back out and say, who is this person? What is their experience? How do we connect? How do we communicate? How do we make that something that's positive? But of course, in healthcare, that doesn't work very well because the system's not set up for that. It's set up in the biomedical model that, Engel was moving against. And I think sometimes we apply the BPS model in a way that we get the questionnaires out, we identify the pain driver. But maybe even being BPS, we're still not being human. We're still not connecting on a human level. We're still not prioritizing that person, how they feel, and these type of things. And that could be because of time. It can be because of training. It can be because sometimes getting into the medical world, it isn't, it's about the science and it's about all the technical aspects, making life and death decisions and these type of objectiveness. And sometimes that misses that person. So what we wanted to say was, what was the true spirit of the BPS model? So I truly believe all of these factors, lifestyle, work, family, have a huge impact. But without a humanistic approach, can we ever get to those things? Can we need, is your patient likely to let you in to talk about all of these factors without a good trusting relationship, without connection, without humanization. So one of the ways that we've applied the BPS model is to make it quite pain focused, not person focused. So we're trying to treat all the bits that influence or drive pain rather than actually saying, let's first connect, communicate, care. There's a good slogan, connect,
That
communicate. I'm
is
going to get a
good.
t-shirt,
I'm
but
stealing
yeah.
that. You didn't copyright. I didn't hear copyright after
Boom.
that.
Yeah.
Instead of live, laugh, love in my room, it'll
Yeah.
say that. Care,
Yeah.
communicate.
We'll have to go back over and realize what I actually said. People do that to me all the time. Do you remember when you said this? And I'm like, no. But yeah, so I think it's that connection, that caring, and those type of things that actually fundamentally open up the paint BPS model. Before I get to that, I need to have that human bit. And I think sometimes we forget that. The BPS model is not identifying a bunch of pain drivers through a bunch of questionnaires. Fundamentally, that is something else.
And do you think of any models that have been better applied? And I know it's always impossible, and it will always be impossible to have a model matched to a human being. As you said, just the human being system is not set up like that. Have you seen anything that's been better at approaching that? I mean, if you're in your first couple of years and you want to have a base knowledge or a base model to look at, something to work from, have you seen anything recently or anything you like to use or think about?
Well, so I'll go back to the great George Box quote. And he said, all models it can be useful, but they're all fundamentally wrong. Right? So that's important that models are models. They're not, they're an interpretation. So they're all wrong, but some are useful. I'm trying to remember the exact quote. So one of the things that we talked about on our BPS paper was this concept of inactivism. All right. And that was really Peter is the main driver of the inactive approach in that stuff. So, you know, I'm not going to take kind of the accolades for that. But an activism, I think, brings the individual into the BPS model. So the one of the things about the BPS model, it's quite nebulous. It doesn't give us much to go on. It's very conceptual, these type of things. What an activism does, I think, is says, what's the story of the person? Yeah, and it's got that kind of phenomenological aspect. Don't say that after a few beers. And really, what that means is you're bringing the person and their story into it, right? What is the lived experience of that person? And looking at, you know, they have the concept of the five E's, where you're looking at it being pain is embedded, it's enacted, it's extended, it's emotional, these type of things. So I think what the inactive model does, and no one actually knows what an activism is. It's, you know, quite woolly within itself, but fundamentally, I think it says, who is this person? What is their story? And I think if we look at that lens, that's very, very useful for the BPS model, because now we're saying humans need caring. I think inactivism may add to that. Who is this human? And what is their story? What is their life? And these type of things. So I think the person provides the model to some degree, if that makes sense. Because without them, we don't have their story and all of these type of things. But you know, I like the lens of inactivism. It's horribly nebulous in the same way the BPS model is. But you're never going to get a humanistic model or a model around humans that's particularly accurate because we have such diversity. But it does say, where do we get the information from for our action and our practice? It has to probably be through the story of the individual. And I have another stupid little saying, which is, if you can't be guided by the evidence, be guided by the person. And that's really what, you know, because there's loads of things that we don't know, isn't there? You know, in the world of rehab. And so I think it's really important sometimes, like, what's the best exercise for back pain? Who knows? But where am I going to get the clues to that question? Probably from talking to my patient. And so I think that, you know, inactivism may provide a little bit more of an individual lens to be able to fill in some of the details from the wider woolly BPS model.
Yeah, and I think that's sort of ties quite well into our next question. So talking about beliefs, I think people often come in with beliefs around their pain and what's caused it and what they need to do for it and what they need to not do for it and what's going on with their back and what's wrong with their movement and all of those sorts of things. It's really hard to address, and I think a lot of the podcasts that I've listened to and people that I've heard talk about beliefs, they often say, yep, like we need to address those beliefs and we need to overcome the beliefs, but they don't really go into the how to actually go about that. And I know when I first started practicing, I was always, you know, someone would come in and they say, oh, I've got back pain because I picked something up and my spine flexed, for example, as a very exaggerated example. And I would just be like, oh, well, you know, you can bend with a flexed spine. That's okay. You don't need to worry about that. But now I sort of realize it's not as simple as just giving them information. You probably need to unravel things a little bit and, It's really hard. So that's a long question, but can you sort of speak to challenging beliefs? When do you do it? When don't you do it? And how?
Yeah. Well, I don't like the terminology of challenging beliefs because I think that sounds combative straight off the bat, right? So it's not collaborative, is it? I'm going to challenge you. And it comes back to things like the writing reflex. Oh my God, someone's wrong on the internet. We have to set them right. And I think that, no one's ever seen those kind of discussions on the interwebs. And I think let's come back to the BPS model. What is the BPS model about? It's about humanism. It's about trust. It's about respect. And I think the best way to talk about beliefs is from a place of trust and respect. That's fundamentally, if that person has trust and respect in you, they are more likely to listen to the opinion that you give. So it's not always the words that you say, it might be the environment in which those words come into. And I think if we work on that humanistic side of things and that connection, and connection isn't you're my best mate, come round for dinner, let's have a barbecue. It's about trust and respect. That is a healthcare connection for me. So I think if we start off from that perspective, people are much more open to having their beliefs challenged. The problem is people, want to, you've never met them before. There's no trust and respect. Suddenly you're saying, no, you're wrong. This is the truth. And what are people going to do? If you're sitting there in the pub, someone's telling a story and you pipe up from behind the bar and say, mate, you're wrong. What do you think the response you're going to get is? I know what my response to you would be. It would be like, you can do one, right? And that's my strong Cockney coming out, right? So I think that's the point, is that we don't have any trust and respect. We don't know these people. And then suddenly we're basically saying, you're wrong. Your beliefs are invalid. And we wonder why people push back. And then what we're doing is sometimes we're searching for the right phrase. Can I phrase this? It doesn't matter what your phrase is. It matters about the relationship that you build. So I think that timing is probably the biggest thing, is when are you challenging beliefs? If it's within the first 3 minutes of meeting someone, then I think that person's going to think you're a bit of a dick, if I'm being honest. So timing is probably your key. I believe in working with belief rather than challenging belief, right? So rather than saying no, I might want to say, oh, why do you think that? Right? So again, maybe we're going to unpack it a little bit rather than saying there, well, no, that's wrong. Or I might say there's an alternative perspective. So actually, we have all this new science. There's some alternative perspectives. Are you interested in that? And I think that sometimes it's about making it less challenging. It's avoiding the writing reflex, and it's thinking about, when am I doing it? It's the classic, walking up to someone in the gym and saying, you're doing that exercise wrong. That always goes well, doesn't it? And that person goes, oh my God, thank you so much for pointing out that I'm wrong. That's
Here's
brilliant.
$20 cash. Thank you
Yeah,
so much.
you've just made my day. That's the best thing that's happened to me today, is you telling me I'm wrong. What do humans do? Humans do what humans do, which is get upset, get annoyed, get frustrated, those type of things. So first thing I always ask is, does it need to be corrected or challenged? Is it influential enough to make a difference? Is it going to be more damaging to my relationship with the person to challenge this than it is going to be beneficial? What's the risk reward? Then let's say we think there is a reward here. Let's say that person, thinks their disc is going to explode when they bend their back. Then I'm going to say, well, what do you think would happen if you bent over? Why do you think that's not great? And then we might explore that. And then I might say, well, would you be open to giving that some tests? I think it's going to be okay. This is fundamentally the bottom end of exposure therapy, isn't it? I think this is going to be okay, but I would love you to find out that it's okay as well. How can we put this together to maybe change a little bit of our, I don't use the word beliefs per se, but change some of our ideas about how the back works. So with respect, slowly and carefully, at the right time, these are the type of ways that I approach, kind of the thought changes or cognitive reappraisal or whatever you want to call it. But I think that the idea of challenging beliefs is often where we go wrong. because that instantly, I think, you know, we want to challenge beliefs with this perfect phrase. And one thing I've learned about communication is there is no perfect phrase. Communication, what you use for one person could offend another person. And again, it comes back to learning about how that person communicates, what their fears are, what their worries are, and working with that rather than try to kind of have some kind of, you know, fundamental, oh my God, Ben, you're amazing. You've totally reappraised my world, which I almost never happens.
Do you find if it's a movement-based belief that doing it, you know, whether it be in a gym or within a rehab space and them going through the movement generally has a good, or they have a good response and give some good feedback?
I certainly believe that education, you know, we look at the kind of education, pain education, these type of things. We need some movement experiences to go with the educational content, right? So most people give up drinking when they have a health scare or give up smoking when they have a health care. They don't give up when the doctor says smoking is bad for you, right? So, you know, it's experiential in that sense, right? So I do think so. One of the problems with pain education has been that it's just words. It's just words. And sometimes we need to see things and feel things for ourselves to start to update some of our kind of concepts and belief structures that we have. And I always talk about, you know, the cognitive and the physical coming together. How do we create a cognitive and physical experience and also allow people to voice their concerns, allow people to help guide us, and those type of things, rather than just say, oh, it's fine to bend. What's your problem?
Yeah. So there's hopefully a model for that. We just haven't found it yet.
Well, no, I think the CFT guys do that really well.
Yeah.
You know, if you look at a lot of the CFT stuff, I think that very much is about, you know, we understanding things like the common sense model, where people have a number of different ways of conceptualizing their problem. But essentially, human beings learn experientially. So how do we create an experience that involves cognitive appraisal, that involves physical action? And I think that's the most likely to get change.
Yeah, for me in the clinic, I work with lots of runners, and I think that example holds true every single day where someone hasn't run for a long time because they've had pain. And if we jump on the treadmill and run for a minute and things feel okay, then when we go back into the clinic room, we talk about a return to run program where they might start with a minute of running, 2 minutes of walking, and they are so much more on board because I can show them proof, hey, you just run for a minute and your foot or your knee felt okay. How would you feel then doing this in a return to run program with 5 minutes worth? And I've done it the other way where I've just said, you know, based off your history, it tells me that you should be able to tolerate that. But then just seeing him in the gym is so much different. They're so much more on board.
Yeah, but that, you know, and does that make complete sense to you when you step back and think about it?
Yeah.
That we learn, human beings learn through experience. And we are there hopefully to provide positive movement and informational experiences that move us forward. The only problem with runners is you do that 1 minute and then sometimes they'll say, I had a guy recently and we had some back pain or some hip pain and we made 5 minutes without any back pain or hip pain. And then I said, oh, this is fantastic. We hugged, we high-fived, best moment ever. And then he came back to me, I think, the next week and said, yeah, I just decided to do another 3 miles after that. And I was like, that's graded exposure gone wrong.
You just look at it and you're like, what are you doing on your phone? Like, oh, I just booked a marathon. I can run 5 minutes. I'll try and run this marathon on the weekend.
Yeah, let's just go for it. And I was like, yes, I know why my job is so difficult.
What do you think on the kind of the rebooking front of seeing people, because we don't want to over-medicalize and I guess over-treat, but challenging beliefs and what someone thinks about their pain just takes time and we would expect it to take time. Do you find you're seeing people a lot earlier, and whether that be saying an acute back pain flare up or an acute heel pain or knee pain where you can speak to them about lots of good things, but they can only take so much in with a consult. I think there's research to say like between 11 or 18% or something is what someone will remember from the initial consultation. Are you seeing them a lot earlier on to then reiterate what you've gone over, or are you finding that you're spacing that out to let them kind of work on things?
Yeah, so I think my approach probably is a little bit more based on self-efficacy, self-management, those type of things. So look, I mean, is it always good to see someone quite early on in their problem? I like to. Does that always happen? I suppose probably not, especially not when you work with quite a few people with persisting problems. So in terms of how I work, if I see some, I like to, obviously I see someone the first time. That's how it generally works. And then I would like to see someone next week. So one of the things that I like to do is say, because my mindset says, you know, I want to make sure, or I want, firstly, I want to make sure I've not made the problem worse, right? So if I'm making the problem worse with my, you know, whatever my advice is, I'd like to know that quite quickly, right? After that, I think then I probably go to about 2 weeks. And then I'll probably go for a month after that. So it tends to be 1 week, 2 weeks, and another month. And I think I probably average about four visits with most people. So I think that the point here is, and you brought this up a second ago, is that, and it goes back to the very first question, why is back pain such a big problem? Because we send people off for a scan. Suddenly you're giving them manual therapy 3 times in a week. You know, I'll come in tomorrow, let's just work, you know, and suddenly we've got over medicalization, over diagnosis, over treatment. And that is a very real problem that we have. And again, we have evidence there that the more medical intervention that you receive in terms of scans and, you know, passive treatment, etc., it does seem to have an effect on prognosis and outcomes. So we need to find that balance between enough support, not enough support, and too much support. And for me, I think that my the way that I space it out tends to be it fits with how I work. But I do think people need to realize sometimes we can make problems worse. And in fact, sometimes persistent pain may be a problem of making things worse through, you know, too much of everything.
I had such a crazy example of this recently. A patient that I've had on who's been on WorkCover for maybe 3 years or so, and have been seeing her regularly for strength and conditioning work just to try and build her overall capacity and just trying to get her a little bit more capable. And recently she got signed off WorkCover, came and saw me a few weeks or a month or so after she'd been cleared. And had no pain has changed at any point during any of that 3 years. Came in a month later and was like, my pain's gone.
Well,
It's just I don't have to rely on anyone anymore. I don't need to go into any appointments. This WorkCover identity that I've had hanging over me is no more, and it's just I feel better. And I was like, wow, we should have done that like 3 years ago. And
and
it
that's
sort of
called
talks to
heart.
that too, that like over medicalization, probably seeing too many people too frequently. Yeah, completely.
Yeah, and I suppose that's what we would call the biopsychosocial model. Is coming back round and saying, what are the societal influences? What are all of these things? You know, it obviously wasn't pathological, was it? You know, that would make no sense to me. Suddenly the disc went back in, or I don't know,
Yeah,
or some, you know,
completely.
I don't know. The TVA magically fired again. Who knows? But you know, I think that it, absolutely that person may say, well, actually, I can work. I am capable. I am ready to get back to the world, and that sound like it may have a profound influence. You know, so I think that's a great example. I think that's brilliant to share that these things happen and they change, and why they change potentially.
How do you find the pain neuroscience research progressing over the last 5 to 10 years? Now, I've been a practitioner for 4.5, Kelly for 5.5, and I thought pain neuroscience was only new when I started reading the research. This it's the same as the biopsychosocial. This stuff's been around for a long time. I'm like, they were doing this back in 2005, which I wasn't even in high school then. So it's been around for a long while, and I thought this was the new psychological revolution. It's great to learn that people were very smart long time ago. What do you kind of think is one of the reasons why it doesn't seem to outperform anything else that we do, but it seems so logical helping people understand what's happening to them and their painful problem? Do you have any thoughts on that, and kind of how you see it best used and best utilized?
Yeah, well, if let's say your chronic pain is driven by some kind of autoimmune problem, right? Let's say there's something going on, there's some kind of change within the immune system, some epigenetic change potentially. Certain things have switched on, you know, things like facilitatory chemicals, and other things have switched off, like inhibitory chemicals. And if we were 10 years ago, I'd reel them off and wow you with my neurobiological knowledge. Why would thinking about it differently change that? Right? So I don't think there's anything wrong with changing people's perception of their problem, in that I start to understand hurt doesn't equal harm, because we have all these neurobiological processes, you know, that's creating all these inflammatory chemicals. It doesn't mean that your spine is crumbling, et cetera, et cetera. That's brilliant. But why does that change that autoimmune problem? You know, it might help me rationalize and make sense of it. Maybe that doesn't always magically take my pain away. So I actually put a tweet out yesterday, and it said, "Pain science helps us understand interventions better. It doesn't always mean that it should be an intervention." And what that means is that does ne the neurobiology of pain help me understand why my exercise doesn't need to be biomechanically specific? Because maybe it's not stimulating or fixing biomechanics. Maybe it's having a neurophysiological or an immunological response, right? I'm stimulating physiological processes. I'm not stabilizing a joint or making a muscle fire or affecting patella tracking. So pain science does a wonderful job of making me understand the all these exercises could help my patient through biological mechanisms that are associated with pain physiology. Right? What that doesn't mean is that suddenly thinking about pain differently magically makes my pain go away. And in fact, I think we're still, and this is why I think we went to the brain, because that starts to, you know, we have sensory transfer from the periphery. That's nociception, right? And then we have a kind of more perceptory based process within the brain that says, you know, how's this meant to emerge and feel? And I think we've focused heavily on the top bit and not always heavily on the bottom bit, right? And they do work together. But if you've got an autoimmune problem or, you know, something like that going on that's driving your issues, maybe your perception of the problem is never going to be able to compete with that. And if you're telling people you should be able to think your way out of this problem, you're probably misguided.
Wow, like a big epiphany moment. Pain science was never for the patient, it was always for us. Just like full circle, explode my brain kind of thing, you know?
Not to say it doesn't help people to understand why it can hurt, but it's not damaging me. You know, that's still important that I can have inflammatory processes in the body. Nociception occurs when I mechanically do something. Nociceptors are multimodal, meaning that they get stimulated chemically, mechanically, thermally, etc. Right? So when I bend over, my back hurts. What that doesn't mean is the biomechanics of my back are creating that pain. It might be mean I'm mechanically stimulating something that's already upset, pissed off, dysregulated. And that's brilliant to understand, but it doesn't mean that it's going to make it go away. Right? So there are benefits, but the length and breadth of what we're trying to prove, or what's trying to be proved, you know, even if you have nociceptive stimulus and it's painful, even all the color research or the, you know, is it hot, is it cold, is it blue, is it red, that only modifies it a little bit. It doesn't change the fact that that nociceptive stimulus was painful. There's still pain. It just changes some of the perceptual aspects that are occurring with that. And I think that's important. If we think, and Louis Gifford said it, didn't he? That the patient who you explain pain to that just got up and went and rode their bike for the first time in 5 years just doesn't exist.
Yeah,
And I
I
think that was
agree.
important. And that's 2014. You know, at the height of the neuro revolution, and we talked about this in our paper, that neurocentric approach. And so I think that we need to step back and say, can it be helpful? Absolutely. Does it help us understand lots of different things? Yes. Does it help patients understand certain things? Yes. But does it literally take people's pain away, blow it into the ether like a white dove? No.
Do you think the, and I'd actually want your thoughts and if there's any research on this, do we know that addressing, say, those beliefs and people understanding that has any benefit in the long term, say 1 year, 5 year, 10 year? If we know that the incidence of an injury is going to be higher if you've had that injury before, the biggest risk factor of an injury is having that previous injury. To someone understanding all these potential contributors and it more on a multifaceted level, does that then help them in the long term? It seems logical, and my belief that it is, and I hope that, and I say to people, we're going through all this information education because if it does flare up again, I want you to have the management tools and understand it better. Do you think that's a, the right way to think? And do we have any research to say that would be the case? Because it's hard to follow someone 20 years and say, oh, did what Blake said 20 years ago, did that help you this time?
It did, buddy. I'm going to back you up, just to
Yeah.
make you feel better. So, I mean, the answer to that is we don't know. But if it does help, I believe it's more behaviorally mediated that affects physiology rather than directly physiologically related. So,
Yeah.
what I mean is the words go into my brain, spark opioids, fire them down my spinal cord, and inhibit pain. There may be some of that that occurs. I probably think that sometimes we understand the problem better, we de-threaten it, and we're more likely to do positive things. So rather than it being a direct physiological link, I think often a better understanding of not just pain, but pathology, timelines, all of the things that can be positive for us to understand and set good expectations, I think that probably is mediated a little bit more behaviorally and has an effect on our physiology rather than directly words trigger, these amazing chemicals that get rid of pain type of thing. So I think it's probably related more to behavior than it is to some kind of direct biological simple link.
Man, that's it. That wouldn't that be an idea if you could just speak and your voice is so beautiful and the words are so great that it just inhibits all the way down and
Oh,
stops the pain.
buddy. I can do
Oh, you
that.
guys can't do
Yeah, I can do that.
that.
I've got a mastermind group that I teach, and I teach them magic. And when we do it all, but it costs a lot of money because I need a new Land Rover.
But it definitely works. That's the thing. Anyone said that doesn't, they're just not doing it right.
Exactly. And I'm the only person who knows how to do it. I want you to know that.
Why do you think Pilates seems to have a really good outcome when it comes to lower back pain? And this is based off that recent systematic review compared to the other things that we generally use and think of.
So, are we talking about the Jill Hayden paper,
I think.
the network
Yes.
meta-analysis? I think
Yeah,
that's the
that.
one that we, 2021. So, I think that firstly, there are problems with network meta-analysis. Speaking to some of my statistical friends in very, very boring conversations, I talked about it as not things to talk about on a first date. Pain science is another thing not to talk about on a first date, because they're exceptionally boring concepts. So, firstly, I think network meta-analysis potentially inflate effect sizes. So that's one of the things that people are talking about statistically. So these network meta, so normal meta-analysis aren't able to pairwise comparison, as I understand it. So a pairwise comparison will take 10 interventions and it doesn't just rank them, it compares them internally against each other, right? So, and again, I'm no statistician, so I may have messed that up. As I understand it, we are seeing some inflation of some of these effect sizes through some of the calculations that are used in a network meta-analysis. So there may be a problem with NMAs in the first place. And I think that's important to highlight. Now, let's just say they're perfect, they're amazing. If you have a really flared up, pissed off back, irritable, upset, like my wife most of the time, are you, sorry, babe, sorry, she can't hear me. She'll find me, she'll get me.
She's not a clinician, is she? She won't listen to this
No,
podcast.
no, no, no. And that was just a joke. She's very happy. So if you had this back that was all sorts of upset, right? And I came along and did 120 kg or 50 kg deadlifts, is that likely to end up in a good place? I don't think so, because if you think about pain, what is pain? It's a stimulus and response system. I stimulate it, it responds. That's it, right? And central sensitization is an example of where the stimulus and the response don't have a good relationship, right? Just think about it like that. So if you think about, the pain system, we stimulate it and we really hammer it. What is it likely to give me?
Pain, lot of pain, intense
Hey!
pain.
And I think that's groundbreaking for some people because when we have exercise, people think more stimulation. If I stimulate my pecs, they get bigger. If I stimulate my biceps, they get bigger, right? So therefore, the more stimulus, the more response that's positive. But pain is a stimulus and response system that you stimulate it, and guess what? It gives you pain. And I think some people really struggle with that concept, is that pain is not hypertrophy, pain is not strength. The more you stimulate it, the more it does what it's meant to do, gives you pain. So I think Pilates is probably a stimulus that's tolerable. So I've got raging back pain. You've come along, I've done a few little movements, feels good, brought some blood flow, brought some fluid, taken bad shit out, brought good stuff in. If you think about, pain, it often causes me to be stiff, creates stasis in fluid flow, oxygen, inflammatory chemicals. I come along, give you a little bit of movement that's relevant for my back pain. I give you a little bit of movement that's safe. I think it's effective because Pilates is good for my back pain. It's a tolerable dosage. No wonder in those situations it gets better. Is it anything, or it feels better, right? Not gets better. We've had that discussion. But so at the end of the day, does it need to be called Pilates? No, it could be any low grade movement. Let's take another one, motor control exercises. They are just low load exercises in disguise. They are tolerable dosage exercises in disguise, right? You don't need all the fancy information and realigning and centration and all this crap that I learned about in the 90s, right? So it's a, for me, and someone else is going to say, Ben, you're wrong, and I'm fine with that. But for me, it's about tolerable dosage. It's about simple things such as blood flow, oxygen, changing hypoxic tissue states, changing pH values, and just basic physiology is that, it's not to do with stabilizing the spine and reducing micro damaging movements and these type of things, which we don't even know how we get to nociception from that. There isn't even a really good physiological link here. So for me, movement is so much more physiological and biological than it is anatomical or biomechanical, right? So movement is just about positive stimulation and positive physiology. And that totally explains why lots of different exercises can have the same result. Because the major part here is the moving, not the movement. Moving stimulates physiology. And it takes good stuff into the tissue and bad stuff out.
I think it's a lot less scary to hear it like that for patients too, to just think about it as movement rather than exercise. Like it's just still, it's a way to de-threaten what they're doing. And particularly if they're in a lot of pain, if they're just moving, that sounds a lot more gentle for them. So, yeah.
Positive movement. That's how I describe my exercises. We are going to do some positive movements. And really, we're setting it up to be positive. We're going to create, hopefully, a safe perceptual environment. We're going to create a positive physiological environment. And hopefully, that produces a, at the very least, with a raging back pain, I didn't make it worse and you moved. And hopefully, what that sparks is this concept of, you know what? This movement thing is okay. I'm going to do some more of it. So I talk a lot about what we do clinically. Is about creating an optimal environment for what we do outside of the clinic. How do we create a positive perceptual and sensory experience that says you're okay to move?
You mentioned central sensitization earlier on. Is there a way that you can assess whether that is a key player in someone's pain, and does it change your management at all?
Great question. I think we've tried with things like the. So firstly, you have to decide what are you talking about? So we have two concepts here. We have a nociceptive concept, and that would be people like Clifford Wolf and, very much nociceptive barrage from the periphery. That starts to upregulate what happens more centrally. we become more receptive to the same stimulus. So nociceptively, we become more receptive, meaning the same stimulus creates a bigger response. So essentially, central sensitization is I bend over a little bit and I get a lot of pain. Those two things are out of whack. They have been modulated internally by your chemistry to be more responsive. They're doing their job better. Right? The pain system is doing its job better. Now, another discussion of central sensitization, and my friend Yonez talks a lot about this, and you know there are some other people that do, is what we call central sensitization syndrome, which is a collection of symptoms such as poor sleep, hypersensitivity, bright lights, medication responses, all of these different type of things. I'm not really big into that, if I'm being honest. So I think that, you know, mechanistically, central sensitization helps explain why your responses are all out of whack. So if someone bends over and it's a one effort, but they get 10 pain, they are likely to be sensitized in some way, right? Mm. But is that central? Is it peripheral? Is it perceptual? I have no idea what's happening in the box. So all that I know is the system is out of whack, right? So can I assess that? Well, yes, I can ask you to bend over very slowly. And if you get a 10 out of 10 pain response, I'm going to say, you seem sensitized, right? I don't know if I can then go much further than that. I mean, I could sit here all day and talk about, you know, Schwann cells and astrocytes and microphages and cytokines and refractory nose, or whatever. It's boring as hell. Told you, don't ever do it on a first date, right? Essentially, what I know is you bend over and it hurts more than it should. So we could say that person is sensitized. Now, one potential explanation for that might be there are central mechanisms occurring in there. Mm. And that's as much as I know. Now, what the hell do I do about it? Really, really simple. I match my stimulus to the level of sensitivity. That's why Pilates works.
I thought you were about to like offer a discount code for some Pilates studio around the corner
Exactly. Yes, no, I have just actually bought a large Pilates coming up.
Coming near you. Fix your back pain in 12 steps.
Exactly. I've got my team on it. My team is just Adam, by the way. So look, I think that these two things go very well together. Something is sensitized and we have an exercise that's quite a low dosage, tolerable stimulus to a sensitized system. Is there any wonder that that can have a positive response?
Mm. What would be your, over the years, your favorite analogy or metaphor to use with patients? Now, I know you said it's on the individual level and you've got some awesome ones. I can't think of the dolls that they're called, but I've seen it on your social a couple of times. Hey, what is it's called something. We open the dolls and there's a bigger doll.
Russian
dolls. Is it Russian dolls?
Yeah, a matryoshka, I think.
Matryoshka, yeah. I really like that and I've used that plenty of times. I just told everyone that I come up with it. No, I'm only kidding. But I do really like that. Have you got any others that you like to use or you found people generally take well when explaining, you know, just things like pain or movement or exercise?
I've got one for clinicians, actually, when it comes to pain science. So I always say it's like going into a mechanic. And the mechanic sits you down and says, right, I'm going to teach you about the engine.
Oh,
if your mechanic was going to give you an engine lesson, what would you say? You'd say, do me a favor, mate. I've got like a million other things I need to do. Just fix the car.
That's so good because Kelly was just at the mechanic and she was saying that.
Anything. Like, I don't know what's going on.
Yeah, but you only care that the car can drive. You're like, just get it serviced and get me back on the road.
And here's a great example of self-efficacy. I have very, very high, and I nicked this off Adam. I have very, very high self-efficacy for driving my car. I have very low self-efficacy for fixing it. So self-efficacy is a very adaptive thing. But anyway, so you walk into the mechanic and it's a lot like pain education. I don't really care. I just want my car fixed. Or I need my car to pick up my kids, which would be a function or a disability or something like that. Right? Do I need to know how the engine works? I don't, if I'm being honest. I've driven a car. I passed my driving test in 1995. I have not worried about the engine since. Right? Do I need to know how internal combustion works? I'm going to be honest. No, I don't care.
But I like the idea that then you could say, but it could, you know, it doesn't hurt to know how to change the wiper fluid or the oil, which means manage a niggle or potentially think about it, move a
I
different
think
way of
that's
a
it.
saw.
So, could you one day need to change the wiper fluid or put water into your car? Absolutely. That's a functional aspect, isn't it? That's a direct functional thing you need to do. Do you need to know exactly how the pipes of the windscreen washer bend round the engine? No.
Damn.
Right? So, yeah. So I think that's a really important analogy for me is that, you know, for pain science, especially, is we don't always need to know the inner workings.
Yeah,
You
I
know,
like
we
that.
want to be able to do things. Now, look, so the Russian doll one or the matryoshka or the babushka, I've had lots of people tell me what it is in different parts of the world. We call that this or we call that that. And I'm like, great. So the idea there is that we often have a little niggle, a strain, a sprain. I pulled my back a bit and then I go to see, you know, the physio or the osteo or the chiro or whatever. And they say, oh my God, your vertebrae is out of place. And suddenly we've gone from this little problem to adding a bigger problem. You know, we've stuck this other doll on it. And then suddenly I go and get a scan and I find all sorts of things going on, right? And then that adds this other doll. And then I go and I see a consultant, you know, a surgeon, and they say, you know, you need to have this operated on, or you're going to be wheelchair bound, or you've got the back of an 80-year-old, and we've had another doll. And then I stop working and I don't do much things with my family, and I'm scared of doing sports, and suddenly I've got this much bigger doll. And at the end, the injury is still the same size. It's all the other shit we've layered on top that's the problem. And I think people get that. They start to understand that it's not just this thing, it's all these other things that have affected my behaviors, my beliefs, stopped me from doing things that I enjoy and value. And suddenly, this little bit of pain has become a big problem. And I think that happens.
I like that. Now, the final two questions that we have, where can people find you? So specific location, address, where are you right now if they want to come and talk about pain? But
Look,
where can people
I've
find
pissed off way too many people to give out my
yeah.
address.
Yeah. So where can people find you? Like socials, courses. You mentioned working with Adam with the BCP, the Better Clinician Project, which we're both a part of, which is awesome for people that are listening there. So yeah, where can people find you? And what have you got kind of coming up this year?
Yeah, so I'm very, very difficult to find. I'm very shy. So look, I'm on Insta at Core Kinetic, I'm on Twitter, I'm on Facebook. I can't recall Kinetic or Benko, I can't remember.
Core Kinetic, I think.
Yeah,
Last time I saw.
I'm always, you know, sometimes it's a little social media for me is a way of testing ideas sometimes and testing metaphors and that I have these crazy ideas and sometimes they work brilliantly and sometimes they absolutely bomb and no one likes it and they hate me and that
That's what
shit.
the delete button's for. That's all right.
100%. And I use things like block and mute very liberally. It's best button on social media is mute. And I do not doubt I am muted by a bunch of people. So that social stuff, I use social media a fair bit. So I'm doing courses I've got, and I was meant to be coming to Australia, but some of my family circumstances changed and I had to move that to next year. I think, where do I go next week? Slovenia. And
That's
then
cool.
in May, I'm in Italy. I'm in Spain and I am in Netherlands. And then in June, I go to Peru.
Wow.
So I think I've taught on five continents and about 45 countries so far.
Wow.
And
Wow.
yeah, just everywhere. So I always think that, you know, I've pissed off half the world and the other half maybe find me tolerable. But it's, you know, it's always been a blessing of mine to be able to bring my message. And sometimes people really like it, and other times it goes against their belief structures and their ideas. So I'm all over the world. And then finally, I also do some stuff with Adam Meakin, sports physio. We run something called the Better Clinician. You call it project, I call it project. And that is really just for people to listen to us, to average clinicians, talk very, very simply about the way that we approach things, often about where we don't do so well sometimes, about where we find the most practical value. We try to keep it fun, not too academic. Sometimes we disagree and argue and show that's okay as well. But fundamentally, it's really for clinicians. And then actually, I'm starting a new job. So I was traveling into London to do a clinic day. And I don't do loads of clinic anymore. I've got lots of other projects. And, you know, I'm taking a slightly different road in my life at the moment. But someone contacted me, and their clinic is about 2 minutes from my house. And
wow.
They said, do you fancy coming doing some stuff? And I was like, I love you. This is the best. So we had a little meeting, and I'm going to go and do a few mornings. I can literally like roll out of bed down the hill and be there. And so that's kind of my dream job, because when you live in London, you always have to travel a bit and it's busy and these type of things. And then I was traveling back into London, which was like an hour. And now suddenly I've got like something at pretty much at the end of the road. And
wow.
I'm quite excited. It's invigorated me actually to get back into doing a little bit more clinical stuff.
That's awesome. I think I know that place. It's the Pilates Studio. Is that it?
100%. Funny you say that, because actually that I was just before the pandemic when I moved down to Kent. I was using a Pilates studio for some clinical stuff. And I've used, I don't know if you, with the BCP, you've seen my boxing club?
Yeah, yeah.
You may have seen that. Well, I've used that as well for a little clinic, because no one's in there in the day. So I just put up a bed, you know, we do stuff. And so I've been quite...
good to hear the backstory.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So it shows you can use lots of different environments. But yeah, no, I'm looking forward to being in a more clinical environment again with other people, which would be nice, because I've been a one-man band for many years. So it'll be nice to get back and doing some stuff as well. Just not too much, because I'm old and, not as fit as I used to be.
And for people listening, we'll have all this tagged in the show notes, socials, course links and things, and hopefully we get to meet, because when you come to Newcastle, we'll both definitely be doing your course next year, so I'll be lovely to meet you in person, and hopefully we can fill out that Newcastle place pretty well, pretty easily, hopefully the whole Australia courses, which will be good. Are you doing Sydney as well?
Well, no, so I've done Sydney twice and I've done Melbourne twice.
Yeah.
And thought that I would try Perth, and I thought I'd try Brisbane. As I say, some things happened in the background that weren't ideal.
Yeah.
But funny, you know, so when I said I was coming, I had my friend Craig at Balmain say, oh, come and do a course, Ben. And you know, suddenly I'm away for like a month, and you know, I've got kids and wives.
Yeah,
and
multiple
wives actually. And it all gets very messy and these type of things. I was recently in New Zealand and I managed to do three courses. I was I was in Christchurch and I did a couple of courses in Auckland. And what I did realize is that traveling 30 hours when you're in your mid 40s definitely takes it out of you. It beat me down.
It's so far away. Really... Australia's just hard to get to.
Yeah, we're good over here, but we're good.
The trip, because it's good. It's really good to, yeah. We had Rich Willie over last year. Oh, was that last year?
Last year, yeah.
Yeah, and that was awesome. Just like a different type of course. And Greg Lehman.
Yeah, we went to Greg's. Greg was in Newcastle as well. Went to his course.
That's star players.
And that's brilliant, because when I kind of first came on the scene, it was very much, you know, you were this type of clinician or this type of clinician, a Mulligan or a Maitland or a McKenzie or whatever. And then and you did McKenzie A, B, C, D, E, F, G, Z, blah, blah, blah. And which is great, no problems. But what I like is you can go and talk to, you know, go and listen to Adam, go and listen to Greg, go and listen to Rich, go and listen to me. And we all kind of have slightly different ideas and thoughts and beliefs. But I think the modern clinicians are a bit more tolerant of these type of things, where you don't have to be the master clinician in one system. And I always say to people, learn from everyone, learn from everything, but try to make it cohesive in some way and try to make it a little bit in line with our modern evidence as well. You know, because a lot of those systems just don't stack up when it comes to the evidence base.
Yeah, I love to see you guys online, you know, picking holes in each other's posts and content in a really, you know, kind of entertaining way. But it's great because you guys both mentioned that, you know, your friends, we talk about this, and this is the only way we're all going to get better together. And it makes it such a safe space for other clinicians, which I think is awesome to see, which is good. Like you and Greg and Adam and that, it's good.
Yeah, look, so from my perspective, everyone's shit stinks, right? That is the truth of the matter. And we have to accept that. I will teach things that are probably aren't as solidly evidence-based as I'd like. I'm going to give you my opinion. I'm going to give you some of the things that have worked for me clinically, potentially, that may have no evidence or no explanation, and they may not work for someone else. But I think we do kind of also just have to have the mindset of, let's just listen, let's learn. I can disagree, that's fine as well. But being open and tolerant to different ideas and different concepts, as long as they have plausibility and some research.
Now, last question. If you could interview anyone on earth, they must be alive. They don't have to be a clinician. Could be Donald Trump, could be Donald Trump if it wanted to be. And you could talk about any topic. Who would it be and why?
So this is, and someone did this on a podcast actually that was really fascinating to me. So actually, it would probably be the Dalai Lama,
Well,
and the reason being is because I've always wanted to. So the key parts of Buddhism are like coming to personal peace, acceptance, relinquishing desire. Some of these things, which I think are positive and negative, but I think that idea of coming to some kind of personal peace really appeals to me from what I see clinically, in the sense that I think so many of us, including me, have a lot of internal turmoil. Life is very turmoil based, isn't it? It has lots of ups and downs. Throw some kids into the mix. Let me tell you, it gets more up and down. And so I really like that idea and that concept of coming to some internal equilibrium and peace and tolerance as well. That's what I like. For an intolerant person, I like the idea of tolerance. Right? And I'm always trying to fight against my own internal intolerance and call myself out on that. And I think trying to understand the mindset of people who've got closer to that or are attempting to get closer to that element of internal peace really appeals to me.
That's a good answer.
Yeah, great answer. Love
I
that.
don't know. And Donald Trump.
In
Just go
the
on the opposite end of these things,
room.
right?
That'd be a very interesting
Just
conversation.
throw some anger and turmoil into it. But that idea, I'm quite into the, I think a lot of the problems that we have in our world stem from internal dysregulation of some type. So how do we find some element of equilibrium? Appeals to me, whether that's unfounded or founded, I don't know.
I like it. I love it. Right, thank you so much for coming on. We'll let you go. People looking to find you, it'll be in the show notes. But again, thank you so much.
No worries. Really, thank you guys for having me on and listening to my, as we call it in England, waffle.
See
I like to waffle.
you later, mate.